Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, another week, another nor'easter. We'll have the latest on the storm that's expected to bring heavy, wet snow into tonight. Also, some New England businesses react to President Trump's proposed new tariffs on steel and aluminum imports.
Any artificial increase to input costs to our business is pretty painful.
Also, Oregon's motor voter law and lessons for Massachusetts.
There's no question in anybody's mind that more people will actually be voting. More of the eligible population will be voting.
Plus,
boy, boy, crazy boy.
Get cool, boy.
Celebrating Leonard Bernstein's 100th birthday with a look at the sustaining power of West Side Story. That's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Forecasters now say more than a foot of snow could fall in parts of New England from this second nor'easter to hit the area in a week. Massachusetts officials today are warning of treacherous driving west of 128 this afternoon into tonight. They say snow could fall at a rate of 2 to 3 inches an hour in some spots, causing whiteout conditions. About 300 crews are already out pre-treating the roads. And for more, we're joined now by WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein. He's joining us via Skype. Hi, Dave.
Good afternoon.
So where's the snow now?
Well, right now we have snow again over central and western sections of New England around New York City, snowing to beat the band. There's actually been thunder snow down there, and these bands will continue to rotate into the area tonight. But for those folks that may be heading home in the next couple of hours from Boston on towards the North Shore, Boston down towards the South Shore and the immediate western suburbs, no problems at all. This will not change over to snow in the next couple of hours.
So what are we talking about for tonight, and when will we be in the height of the storm, if you will?
So in Boston, I think after 9 o'clock is when we'll really start to see a changeover. So we have several hours of rain actually across the area, which is going to keep the roads pretty wet, probably between 7 and 9 o'clock in that 495 to 128 belt. And then it's going to change over even earlier in the next few hours. In some places, it's already beginning to change over further north and west. So that line is basically collapsing to the coastline.
And snowfall totals.
So snowfall totals, we've upped these a bit for the 495 to 128 belt. And we talked about this a lot over the past couple of days, that was the area that was just so unsure. It depended on exact track of the storm. So still, we're looking at anywhere from 10 to 16 inches through Worcester County. So that's, you mentioned at the top of this, some places getting over a foot. As you get towards the 495 to 128 belt, 6 to 12 inches. And then right in Boston, just to the north across the North Shore and just to the south, 4 to 8 inches. As you get a little further south, it will go 2 to 5 inches. Cape and the Islands according to a couple of inches. And the outer tip of Cape Ann, maybe 3 to 6 instead of 4 to 8. But you get the idea. It's a little bit less there.
Mm-hmm. And so when will it end? I mean, what are we talking about? Will we get all of this? You're saying 9 o'clock tonight in Boston? Is all of this happening tonight? And what's the morning commute going to look like?
That's right. So all of this does happen tonight for the most part. There still could be an inch or two tomorrow after sunrise, but this is basically an overnight storm. So when we get up tomorrow morning, the crews will be working on cleaning this all up. I suspect there's going to be school delays and cancellations. And depending on exactly how much snow Boston gets will depend, obviously, on the cancellations and delays right downtown.
And of course, coastal flooding was a big issue in last week's nor'easter. What does this storm do to affect the coastal areas in particular, Dave?
Right. So a couple of things. One is the winds will not be as strong, so coastal flooding will not be as bad. That said, there is a coastal flood warning up from Cape Ann all the way down through the South Shore. The Cape and the Islands have a coastal flood advisory, so that's a little bit less serious. So we're looking at moderate to perhaps on the line of major coastal flooding. We won't see anything like we saw last weekend, but as you've all been reporting, we've had these breaches in dunes and in some cases seawalls. So in some ways it makes it easier, even though the flooding wouldn't typically be as bad. There's places that are more vulnerable than they were back on, say, Thursday afternoon.
Mm-hmm. After this, does the forecast look fairly storm-free for a while?
What's a while?
I know, right?
right? So we do go storm free here Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, but there is the potential for another nor'easter here sometime late Monday or Tuesday, and that potential is real, so we'll have to keep an eye on it. I think after that, we probably will start to undergo a pattern change, but we may have one more of these to go through. A
pattern change called spring, maybe? Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I don't want to use that S word just yet, but let's get rid of the nor'easters first.
All right. WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
The latest rebuke to President Trump's proposed tariffs on steel and aluminum came from both home and abroad today. Meeting in Brussels, European Union officials outlined possible tariffs on American-made products if the U.S. follows through with the president's plan. And here at home, the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is urging the president to refrain from the tariffs and is warning that a trade war will be the likely result. President Trump maintains that these tariffs will help protect the steel and aluminum industry.
You will have protection for the first time in a long while, and you got to regrow your industries. That's all I'm asking. You have to regrow your industries.
Joining us now is Sam Blatchford. He's the president of American Steel and Aluminum LLC, owned by the Nova Steel Group, which is based in Quebec but also has offices in Massachusetts. He joins us from Portland, Maine, where he is today. Hi there, Sam.
Hey, how are you, Deborah?
I'm okay. Well, the president's tariff plan involves a 10% levy on aluminum imports, 25% for steel. How would this affect your business?
So really, I mean, I got to tell you, it would be much easier to take Dave's job and just predict the weather over the next few days, I think. But really, it's a matter of us making sure that we can shore up our supply chain to be able to service all of our customers throughout New England. And certainly, we want to make sure that we have Canadian steel on our side, because those really are the closest mills to our facilities where we process the metal and ship it into the manufacturing base.
Mm-hmm. So your job might be easier, but really, seriously, is it going to affect prices? What will be the effect?
Yeah, so even just with a lot of the discussions around the Section 232, we've seen a dramatic increase in prices between anywhere from 25 to 40%, depending on the product category. Now, again, at the end of the day, how much does that affect the cost of a car, or how much does it affect the cost of a can of beer? You know, I think it's fairly minute. It's more about availability, making sure that we do have an ample supply, and obviously we have some layered on trucking issues that have been the talk of the town as well with a lack of truckers. So it's difficult to get the material into New England to begin with. Hmm.
So where are you seeing the bigger rise in prices? And explain that a little bit. Is it the steel? Is it the aluminum? I mean, explain to folks. We've told folks that you're the president of American Steel and Aluminum, but explain those prices and what you do and how that works.
Yeah, sure. So what we do is we act as a middleman between producing mills, both for aluminum and stainless steel, as well as carbon steel. And we buy coils or beams and things, and we process them into usable products. So we may slip the coils into smaller coils. Then a stamping operation would then stamp out automotive gaskets or fire extinguishers or build stadium seating out of it.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned Canada, and Canada has been seeking an exemption here. President Trump has said that would only happen if there is a new North American Free Trade Agreement. If there are no exemptions, do you expect that you would still be affected?
Yeah, so I think what would happen is we'd see a little tighter market in New England. Certainly, again, there's more freight coming into New England, more freight cost. And if you look at carbon steel, freight can represent 10 to 15% of the inbound cost. And if you're bringing it from Chicago instead of Hamilton, Ontario, there's quite a difference in transportation costs.
Hmm. Are you concerned about what we're hearing about this threat of a trade war and what we're hearing from the European Union officials today?
You know, not as much. I think that, again, it's a lot of positioning right now. I think we're out looking to get good deals for America. And I think this is a lot of posturing. And I think it's, it certainly has brought a lot of people to the table. I'm hoping, like the rest of us, that all these will be settled in very amicable ways. And I do want to add that we have a lot of great trading partners throughout the world, but we also have a lot of bad trading partners. And we want to focus on continuing working with the good trading partners where we have similar standards of living, similar environmental rules and regulations, safety rules, and livable wages. and just get away from the ones that are, you know, the third world where we're basically siphoning our wealth into their economies. Hmm.
You know, Monday, the president tweeted, we must protect American steel. And on Twitter last week, he said American steel and aluminum industries are dead. What do you make of those comments from the president?
So they're certainly not dead. We have some of the most efficient producing mills in the world and some of the best technology. And we've been building some new mills in North America, but we've had a lot shut down. And we've been bringing in, you know, more and more imported steel. And back in 2014, we brought in, you know, well over 35% of our material, and it was unfairly traded and dumped onto our shores. So we do need to have some regulation. We want fair trade, not free trade. So, but as far as our industry goes, we have a strong industry, but we have some unfair trading going on, and we just got to make sure that we're able to make a living here so we can reinvest. And I'm talking about our mill suppliers, our mill partners. We want to make sure that they can continue to invest in this technology and continue to grow their footprint.
Mm-hmm. All right, Sam Blatchford, president of American Steel and Aluminum LLC, which is owned by the Nova Steel Group based in Quebec. Sam, thanks for being with us today.
All right, Deborah, thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. We spoke with another local businessman as well who reacting to the president's proposed steel and aluminum tariffs. Rick Maher is chief commercial officer of Lord Hobo Brewing Company based in Woburn. This is what he said.
We're concerned about tariffs. Any artificial increase to input costs to our business is pretty painful. Big part of our business is in aluminum cans, and you know, almost the rest of our business is in steel kegs. So increasing those input costs by 10 or 25% is a drag and you know, money that otherwise could be invested in our growth.
And joining us now with some analysis of local businesses and of the big picture is Evan Horowitz. He's the Boston Globe's Quick Study columnist. Thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Deborah.
So we heard from two local companies about...
Quasi-local
companies about this proposed... Well, we wanted to hear from folks, you know, how they're reacting here. So it was, you know, we had some kind of a story about a home effects on this. But EU officials essentially raised the prospect of a trade war. You've written that it's the international fallout here that's really the key issue. What did you mean by that?
So, I mean, I didn't mean it a disparaging way to say it was quasi-local, just really to emphasize how integrated these international supply chains are. It's very hard to do a local story because what matters here is the interaction between what's going on in the U.S. and what's going on in Canada and what's going on in Europe. I don't think foreign countries are posturing. I think they're preparing. They're really preparing to retaliate. This is not outside the norm. In the past, when we have imposed tariffs, the standard response is retaliatory tariffs. They don't always have to escalate. Sometimes you find a new equilibrium, but I think we should expect to see new tariffs imposed by Europe, by China, by people who are angered by this move.
Hmm. You know, we talked about prices going up, and Sam Blatchford told us that he's already seeing some increases that will likely be passed on to consumers, right? Do you think that this will be happening and it will be significant?
So, yeah, I mean, it helps to sort of separate this into a couple of boxes, as it were. When you have tariffs, it helps the protected companies. So the manufacturers, the U.S. manufacturers, they're going to see a boon. It's going to help them. But the reason it helps them is because it drives up the price. So they get to sell their steel for more money, right? Mm-hmm. And the rest of us have to buy that steel for more money.
Right.
And there are a couple of possibilities. One is that the intermediate companies, think car companies, right? They need a lot of steel. They're making cars. Or this brewery, Lord Hobo. That's a great name for a brewery. this brewery, they need it for their kegs and their cans. They're going to pay a little bit more. That doesn't necessarily mean they'll pass it along to consumers. Some of them will, some of them won't. It depends on whether they think consumers will still buy it at a higher price. Some of them will eat the additional cost. So there will be some pass-through, which means some of us will see higher prices in the store, and there will be some that won't be passed through, which means some of these sort of middlemen that use steel and aluminum, they're going to have to eat these losses.
You know, we mentioned the possible exemption, maybe with Canada. Canada says it wants an exemption. And the president has sort of left the door open on possible exemptions if there's a new NAFTA. So is this a way for the president to renegotiate a new NAFTA, really?
Yes, it's always so hard to interpret the musings of our president. I think if there's a new NAFTA is akin to if the snow never happens tonight or if the sun doesn't come up tomorrow. That is, I don't think that can happen, certainly not on this time scale. It's possible there will be an exemption for Canada, but it won't be because we've suddenly come to a resolution on outstanding NAFTA issues. It'll be because someone gets to the president's trade team and says, look, you really need to do this exemption. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. And without an exemption, it's really hard to understand the strategic logic behind this. I mean, the way they frame it, China has been overproducing and dumping. That seems to be true. But if the goal is to stop them from doing that, it would make sense to get all the allies together and apply pressure to China, not to infuriate Canada and Mexico and Europe and all the people who should be on your side, forcing China to stop dumping their steel.
So do you think an international trade war is likely from this?
The good news, I think, is that it's really not hard to stop a trade war. People just have to say, you know what? People have to look at the strategic situation and say, actually, we're going to end up losing. And that will happen eventually, that someone will look at it and say, ooh, we could have retaliatory tariffs, but how far is this going to escalate? And ultimately, we're going to get hurt. Let's just, you know, let the U.S. have its 15%, its 25% tariff for a short period of time, see what happens. I think that's the sort of best case here is a trade war, some trade tiffs starts, and someone, whether it's Europe or China, eventually says, you know what, this just isn't worth it. Let's just leave it as is. We'll go to the WTO and we'll fight it. So my hope is still it's easy enough to stop a trade war that we won't have a really damaging trade war, but the odds have gone up this week.
Now, the EU officials did mention that there were doubts on some folks' part anyway that this would be approved by the WTO. Is that a big issue here?
It's a huge issue. The last time we had steel tariffs was about a decade, well, about 15 years ago. And the WTO ultimately overruled them, and we had to remove them. Now, we're using a different rationale this time. But in fact, the rationale seems to be even weaker than the one we used 15 years ago. And it doesn't seem like the WTO would approve it. I think the bigger concern is what happens if we go to the WTO? We don't go to the – if the people who are hurt by this, our allies in China, they go to the WTO, and the WTO rules against the U.S. and our president says, who cares? Right? Then you have a real threat to an international trade system that has been decades in the making. And I think everybody around the world is most concerned about that scenario, that you could have a real unraveling of one of the most stabilizing economic institutions in the world.
Have we heard from China on this, which has what? It produces about, what, half of the world's steel?
Produces a lot of world steel. China's in an interesting position here. I'll answer your question first. We haven't heard as much as we will from China. So they're still keeping it close to the vest. China's an interesting position. They produce a ton of steel. They also use a ton of steel. We don't import a lot of steel from China. Like, most of our imports come from Canada, they come from South Korea, they come from Germany, from Brazil. China's not even in the top 10. And it's not because they don't produce a lot of steel, it's because they use a lot of it domestically. So they're in an interesting position. They're not going to be directly affected by these tariffs because they don't export that much steel to us or aluminum. So it's not clear how exactly they'll respond, but we are likely to see a response.
I wonder just about the whole premise here of the steel industry and reviving the steel industry in general, right? There are folks who say, you know, it's not about bringing the steel industry back, really. Things have changed. You know, we're not in the 1950s anymore, where car makers were such a big deal here and employing people at the level that maybe would make America great again, if you will, right? So is this just a flawed premise, you know, on a broader level?
Mostly a flawed premise. But I will point out one thing that has been interesting to me and that most people aren't talking about. If the big problem is China is dumping steel and that's killing the U.S. domestic steel industry, how come Canada still has a thriving steel industry? How come South Korea still has a thriving steel industry?
Good question.
And part of the answer, as I'm learning, I think, is that it has to do with the productivity of these industries. That is, they made productivity changes earlier than U.S. mills did. And so we could still make productivity changes to improve the domestic industry. And another part has to do with international currency issues. So there are other things we could do, but I think there's some more fundamental problem with the U.S. steel industry that needs to be addressed. Otherwise, the Chinese dumping problem would be affecting other partners, and it isn't.
Okay. Evan Horowitz, the Boston Globe's quick study columnist and a regular here on Radio Boston. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
Stay with us. Coming up, how Oregon implemented automatic voter registration and lessons Massachusetts might learn from that. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, voter registration might change in Massachusetts. Two bills pending at the State House would do so. One would allow same-day voter registration. The other would allow the automatic registration of eligible voters, a so-called motor voter law. Last month, Attorney General Maura Healey gave her support, saying that automatic registration would help bring almost 700,000 unregistered eligible Bay State voters to the polls. Oregon is one state that has already implemented automatic registration, and the former Oregon Secretary of State and current head of the Democratic Party of Oregon, Jean Atkins, was on Beacon Hill talking about that experience with Massachusetts leaders today. She's with us in the studio right now. Jean Atkins, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
So 10 other states in the District of Columbia have implemented motor voter laws. The first among them, as we said, Oregon in 2016. How does it work there?
Well, every day the Department of Motor Vehicles takes a look at the data that has come through that day for people who have registered for a new driver's license, renewed a driver's license or a permit or an ID card, and takes the data for those who meet the qualifications of being a voter. They have an appropriate age, they have an appropriate residence address, they have an appropriate citizenship status, and they give a report to the Secretary of State's office. We match that against our centralized voter registration database. And if somebody isn't registered, we start a process, a 21-day process for them to become registered. We let them know by mail. They can opt out. They can add a party registration, which is the one thing that DMV doesn't collect. And through that process, now we're about at 425,000 folks have registered through the first 2 years of the program.
Wow. And so do you know how it may have affected in terms of political affiliation?
Those that do return the card and ask to be affiliated with a party are doing so at approximately the same rates as our regular registration process. So we're a slightly Democratic edge registered state and slightly more of them register as Democrats. But it does not seem to have an impact on the overall voter registration of the state.
And how about participation? Are those folks who are being automatically registered actually voting?
We were very lucky to start in January of 2016 and have a very big election in November of 2016, as we did in every state. And at that point, we had about 275,000 folks who had been registered, and almost 100,000 of them voted in November. Hmm. That's a lower percentage than those who have been registered traditionally. But overall, the proportion of qualified Oregonians who participated in that November 2016 election was higher than it's ever been.
It's higher because, you know, that's an argument, right?
Right.
We've heard this from Sean Harrington, who's a member of the Republican State Committee in Massachusetts, talking about implementing automatic voter registration like that here in this state. And he says, you know, this is not a remedy for low turnout. All it does is register people who don't really want to vote anyway.
Well, that wasn't our experience last November, and maybe proportionately they will vote at a slightly less of a rate. But adding 100,000 voters into the pool for our November election and recognizing what an increase that made in the qualified people participating, it was a very positive result.
Here in Massachusetts, it might be a little different. I'm told that the proposal would let the Registry of Motor Vehicles here and MassHealth, the state-subsidized health insurance program, add eligible voters to the rolls, and then they would have to opt out if they were to be included. In your talks with Beacon Hill leaders today, did you get into that nitty-gritty of the legislation?
I did learn that they were going to do that as well. Most states have some connection with their human services programs because a National Voter Registration Act requires that you give people the opportunity to register. Massachusetts may be breaking some ground here with respect to the MassHealth automatic voter registration. But we certainly know that not everybody gets a driver's license. And the point is for everybody who has this opportunity and to flip the switch to opt out as opposed to opt in, I think really makes a psychological difference and they will see greater participation all across the board.
You know, we've heard an awful lot about hacking. And so I think protecting security in a case like this, particularly if you're dealing with two public entities like the Registry of Motor Vehicles in Massachusetts and then state subsidized health insurance, we've heard all sorts of folks having theories about whether there were Russians trying to get at our voter rolls and all of that. Right. I mean, how do you make sure that this information is secure?
Well, we have that problem no matter what, whether we change our systems or whether we add to our systems and make them more efficient. Certainly, you have to have security. These are not records that are being transferred over the internet from one agency to another. This is particular connection, IS connections that need to have all the security standards there. Most states have a connection already to the Department of Motor Vehicles. That's the way you get online registration and you capture a signature from your driver's license record to be added to your voter registration. So we are into an online system. Back in the day, we worried that people were going to turn in a bunch of fraudulent voter cards and mess up the system. You do have to protect against those things, but we also can implement security to help us.
Have you done that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. We were one of the states who, from some foreign sources, we don't always know who, saw evidence that they were pinging and trying to get into our system. But with the kind of random and constant monitoring, we were always able to identify and block anything that came our way. There isn't a perfect solution to that now that we're in a digital age, but we don't think that the automatic voter registration system adds risk into the system. It actually makes it more accurate and a much more efficient way to do our business.
And what about costs? Were there additional costs?
There was an additional investment, and we particularly focused on making sure that the county clerks, and in our state, it's the counties that do the election work ultimately, that they got a little extra compensation for additional registrants coming into the system. And we had to do some, obviously, programming work and application development to do the matching that we needed, and so there was investment there. But we think the savings on the other end, more savings than we would have predicted around the fact that now we have up-to-date addresses for all our voters. And in a state like Oregon, where we mail ballots to the voters, that was very important. And the counties all reported many fewer returned ballots, which is a cost savings over the long run. Hmm.
Just briefly, any advice to Massachusetts, having gone through this? If Massachusetts does it, what's a big bit of advice?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern. There was in Oregon, I think that it's been raised here, that people will reject the notion somehow that we are automatically registering and asking them to opt out. There certainly were a few of those folks in Oregon, and they do opt out, and sometimes they do it vociferously with a few little messages about why they didn't want to. But it was very, very minimal. And actually, there were folks who had been to the DMV and were not registered in time for the November election because of our voter registration deadline. And they protested. Oh my gosh, I went to the DMV. I thought that meant I was registered, you know, but they weren't finally. So we think that the positive reaction really outweighs any of the negative reactions that the public has.
Okay. Jean Atkins served as Oregon's Secretary of State during their automatic registration rollout in 2016. She's now head of the Democratic Party of Oregon. Jean, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And now it's time for our weekly sports segment with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Deb. It's a pleasure, as always.
So let's start with a local story.
Which won't be a pleasure to talk about.
I know. It's so odd, right? So let's say the superintendent of East Bridgewater Schools issued an apology after the East Bridgewater girls basketball team beat Madison Park 93-7.
Right.
So explain.
Well, there are a number of things that are worth attention in this story. The first thing that came to mind after I started kind of reading about this, because I wasn't at the game, one of the young women who played for the Madison Park team said that the East Bridgewater team was pressing through the whole game. And for people who don't really understand how basketball works, pressing means that you you bother the other team right from the point they bring the ball out of bounds from their end, and half the time you don't allow them to get the ball over half court. Now, that sounds like exactly what happened, because if you only score 7 points during the course of an entire game, it sounds like that's what happened. So the East Bridgewater coach obviously was making no adjustment for the fact that his team was getting further and further ahead throughout the game. The second thing that struck me was one of the players for the Madison Park team said she was so discouraged after the game that she wondered whether she'd ever play basketball again. And that's not the kind of atmosphere that you want to create for kids playing a basketball game. This was a young team, mostly freshmen. They had no tournament experience. As some of the kids on that team said, they had no experience with a game that big. And I think they were very poorly served.
But it's a superintendent.
Obviously, there were. The superintendent apologized, so he agrees with me.
Issuing an apology is unprecedented.
It's certainly unusual. I have heard of opposing coaches and school officials issuing apologies in similar situations in the past, but this is so extraordinary, so extreme, that I'm glad that an apology was forthcoming, because it certainly was required, I think, in this circumstance.
Let's talk briefly about the Red Sox. J.D. Martinez joined the lineup at spring training in Florida today. He's late to camp because of delayed contract talks. But at this point, can we even say how's the team looking so far?
Oh, this is the best point to say how the team is looking so far.
I can't hold you to it.
The Red Sox are one of the many teams that look great. It's early March. They all look terrific. They could all go 162-0, or at least that's the way they think at this particular point. So optimism runs rampant at this point. They're a good team. The managerial change should help. There was some sense last year that there was some sense of unpleasantness in the clubhouse. So the managerial change should help, and Martinez obviously should help, although, as I said, when he was first signed, I don't think you can necessarily expect that he's going to replace David Ortiz in terms of either production or length of service. But, hey, at least you got to give him credit for going out and getting somebody who hits home runs.
Speaking of Red Sox, there was a sad story out of North Carolina. Former Red Sox pitcher Sammy Stewart, he played for the team during the 1980s.
Yeah,
he was found
briefly,
dead at his home on Friday.
1 year with the Red Sox, mostly Sammy Stewart played for the Baltimore Orioles, and by all accounts was a delightful an entertaining member of that team, famous for his good stories and his performance. He was a superb pitcher as well for a period of time. Unhappily, when his baseball career was over, he had some tragedy, lost a son to cystic fibrosis, a little boy who was only 11 years old, and Stewart's life kind of fell apart. He was arrested several times. He had addiction issues, and it's a shame. But quite often when athletes get to the end of their athletic career, it's a tough adjustment. And for him, obviously, an adjustment terribly complicated by the death of a child.
Right. Well, we've certainly heard about it before with
absolutely.
Athletes, so I know that it's happened before. Also, sort of in the same vein there, Cavaliers player Kevin Love wrote in the Players Tribune about his experience with a panic attack during a game and some of the shame surrounding that incident and mental health issues.
Yeah, it's a very interesting. You never know with the Players Tribune the extent to which the player himself has written the thing and the extent to which his agent or somebody else has participated. But it's a very interesting piece. The positive side of it is that Kevin Love acknowledges that until this panic attack that he had a couple months ago, basically at halftime during a game, he had never really thought about any sort of social, psychological, mental health issue having any kind of impact on him. He thought that was something that other people had to deal with and not him. And suddenly was confronted with the fact that it was something he would have to deal with, and he has been dealing with it. The only thing that makes me a little bit uncomfortable with that piece is that he seems to be suggesting that seeing a therapist a couple of times is pretty well going to take care of it.
There you go. All done.
For some people, sure, all done. And for other people, It's there are circumstances they have to deal with over a much longer period of time. And I wish him well. I think it's great that he's come out and talked about this and is addressing it.
Right. Certainly folks are more aware, more open about mental health issues. They've gotten more open in, over the years. But is there something in particular about sports that makes it difficult for athletes to sort of admit to this?
I think there are two things. One is there's an ethic in sports, which is basically rub some dirt on it and get back on the field. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether what you're rubbing dirt on is an injury to your knee or your elbow or some sort of psychological or social issue that you're trying to deal with. Get out there. You know, can you go? Can you play? The other part of it is that to get to the highest level in any sport, unless you are just a supremely talented athlete, you have to really devote yourself to that sport to an extraordinary extent. And when the time for devoting yourself to that sport ends, as it does for athletes, at the same time that many of their peers are just hitting their stride, if they're lawyers or doctors or business people, that's a tough adjustment. What do I do now? There's a marvelous article about Ichiro Suzuki, the Japanese player, just came out, that his entire life is built around making himself the best baseball player he can possibly be. And he's in his mid-40s, and people who know him, somebody said to him, what are you going to do after you retire? And he said, I guess I'll just die.
Oh my gosh.
The people who know him say they don't know what he's going to do because everything he does is built around getting prepared to play baseball as well as he possibly can. It's a very tough adjustment for elite athletes.
All right. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs right here on WBUR, Saturdays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. He joins us Wednesdays to talk sports. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. This year marks the 100th birthday of composer and conductor Leonard Bernstein. The native of Lawrence, Massachusetts, was well known for his music, especially for scoring the Broadway hit West Side Story. Bernstein's legacy is front and center in the latest performance by conductor and composer Rob Capello. In his What Makes It Great series, Capello unveils Note by Note, musical magic. And he joins us in studio now to talk about the brilliance of Bernstein. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome back, I should say.
Thanks.
Bernstein, born in Massachusetts,
yep.
Went to Boston Latin, Garrison Grammar School, attended Harvard. But in 1960, he wrote about the first time that he saw ballet. And he said he heard the great music of Beethoven for the first time. And since then, he never heard or conducted work without some deeply stirring memory of that visual event. So what do you think it was about Beethoven that Bernstein was responding to?
Well, you know, Bernstein was always connected to Beethoven. And in fact, he did a whole television show, a famous television show on the Fifth Symphony, where he put the sketches of the Fifth Symphony actually on the stage. And his sort of point was that, you know, we think of this music as just having descended from the heavens, perfectly written. But you look at these Beethoven sketches, it would take him 50 sketches to actually get to what he would call the sort of inevitable perfect version. And, you know, for Mozart, for composers like me, you know, you look at a Mozart score and you want to kill yourself. I mean, there's no mistakes, there's no crossouts, there's no erasures. You feel so much better when you look at a Beethoven score because you see all the agonizing scrawls, the crossouts, and you see that, you know, it got to this incredible version, but the hard work is right there on the actual page itself. And I think that Bernstein was connected to Beethoven. First, he talks a lot about that sense of inevitability in Beethoven, that the story could not be told in another way, that each note follows another note. But I think what really actually got him about Beethoven, as we often see in other people, what's deeply in ourselves, right, was that what Beethoven was really about was about connection, about taking musical ideas that no one would have ever seen as connected before and making them connect. Beethoven's all about looking past the surface differences that seem to separate us. You know, it's no coincidence that when the Berlin Wall came down, it was Beethoven's Ninth Symphony that they played. Hmm. Alle Menschen werden Brüder. All men shall be brothers. That's what Beethoven is all about. And it's so poignant because there was no human being who was actually worse with other human beings.
Right.
I mean, he was the worst dinner guest ever. But, you know, deeply there, especially alone, death, separate from the world, writing this music about all men shall be brothers, all men shall be connected. And I think that at heart is what made Bernstein so special. Beyond being a great conductor or being a great musician or a pianist, he was about connecting, about taking this music and connecting it to everyone. You know, when Bernstein talks about Beethoven, he talks about his universality, about his ability to connect with anyone, from the most sophisticated to the most uneducated, that his music reaches everyone. And that's what Bernstein's entire life was about. Mm. All the television shows, you know, he once said, if he hadn't been a musician, he would have been a rabbi.
Really?
You know, because I think that's what he was. He was an evangelist for this music. His first instinct when he came to music he loved was to find a way to share it, to get it across, whether it was children's concerts, whether it was the Omnibus television series, whether he was playing, whether he was a musical ambassador. So I think it's connection that moved Beethoven, and it's connection that moved Bernstein to be moved by Beethoven.
Okay. And that, is that what you love about Bernstein, that feeling of trying to connect?
Well, I think what I love about Bernstein is, first of all, this incredible, passionate intensity in everything he did. I mean, you really get this feeling that whether he was conducting a piece of music or playing a piece of music or talking about it, that at that moment, this was the greatest thing ever, that he was sharing with you the most important secret and the most important thing he could. And so I think it's that passionate intensity and conviction, and also the belief that there's only music. In other words, we often make distinctions between classical music, popular music, Broadway music, symphony music. To Bernstein, it was all music. You know, there's a great quote from Duke Ellington. He says, there's only two kinds of music, good music and the other kind. And Bernstein lived that. I mean, he was castigated. You know, now everyone looks back at West Side Story and all the music I'm going to be talking about Friday from Wonderful Town and On the Town, as this was great. But when he was in Boston for the opening night of On the Town, Serge Koussevitzky, the conductor of the Boston Symphony and his mentor, spent 3 hours telling him he was wasting his time, throwing away his talents on something as worthless as a Broadway musical. But for him, it was all music. Whether it was classical music, Broadway music, jazz, piano, it was all music. And I think that's what's so moving, his ability to share all music with anyone.
Now, for your performance, you've singled out one of Bernstein's early works, Wonderful Town.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the goal for this program is really to put Bernstein's achievement in a way, in a kind of context. Everybody thinks of West Side Story, the greatest thing ever, you know, landmark musical of 1957. But I wanted to try to put it in context, both of his earlier music, because people don't know his earlier music, On the Town and Wonderful Town, but then also in the context of the other great theater music of the time. So I start the show with this song, A Little Bit in Love, from Wonderful Town, which is 1953, only 4 years before West Side Story. And that's what we begin with.
Hmm. Okay, we do have a recording of A Little Bit in Love, a 1999 recording of A Little Bit in Love from Wonderful Town. And this is sung by Audra McDonald. Let's listen.
I'm a little bit in love. Never felt this way before. Just a little bit in love, or perhaps a little bit more.
So tell us about this.
And doesn't the whole mood of the entire station just change when you listen to this music?
It's great. It's really. And remember, it's different.
Remember, this is the Bernstein who was conducting Mahler symphonies. This is the Bernstein who wrote his Jeremiah symphony. But it's just this incredibly relaxed music. It's Bernstein with this incredible love, facility, and affection for the Broadway popular music of his time. Stepping out of his white tie and tails from the New York Philharmonic and swinging. You know, just take that opening phrase. You know, this little phrase. Now, I mean, first of all, if he had done classical rhythm, if he had been at the New York Philharmonic, it would have had square rhythm, bum, 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 like this. I'm a little bit in love. But there's this wonderful slide on the very first note. He goes, that little slide. I mean, that's Bernstein, the conductor of the New York Philharmonic. That is what it feels like to be a little bit in love. And then that swing rhythm instead of this. It just swings easy. And I'm just a little bit in. And that wonderful rhythm, a little bit in love, that little syncopation brings it to life.
That's beautiful.
And, you know, I mean, just one more thing I can't resist. The next phrase, never held this way before. You know, if you played that left hand alone, you might recognize it. It's the same left hand as heart and soul. Which becomes... This is Bernstein loving the world of popular music, facility and affection. That's where he started as a composer.
So put him just in a little bit of context for us here in terms of Broadway shows at the time. What was going on here?
Yeah, as I say, this was the music of the time. This fit in perfectly to the shows that were going on. But 57 is when he wrote West Side Story. 56. The Tony Award-winning musical was actually My Fair Lady, and I Could Have Danced All Night, which we'll actually compare to tonight in our actual show. So the year before, the Tony Award-winning musical was My Fair Lady, but the year of West Side Story, amazingly enough, Music Man beat out West Side Story for Best Musical of 1957, which is really astonishing.
Can we have to make sure that we get the West Side Story ballad in here because, sheesh, if we didn't do that, we'd be in big trouble. So we do have a recording of it of somewhere from the 1957 original Broadway cast of West Side Story. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
Okay.
That's what we all know from
West Side
Story.
What an amazing beginning if you actually think about it. First of all, the whole idea of a musical that's a tragedy. I mean, musicals are supposed to have happy endings. Mm. I mean, here is one in which the three main characters are killed off. In fact, producers were unwilling to actually invest in the show because they thought it was such a downer. I mean, it's Romeo and Juliet, but it's a tragedy. But even that beginning, I mean, first of all, she starts off with just by herself, two notes. That leap, by the way, is the only leap of a minor seventh that I know, maybe somebody will call and tell me I'm wrong, of any opening popular song. You know, Somewhere Over the Rainbow starts with an octave leap. That's a big leap, very rare. And in fact, producers thought that song would never be a success because it's too hard to sing an octave. But this is even worse. It's a minor seventh, the hardest interval to sing, and it's unaccompanied with no help. I don't know of any other piece that begins with that. But not only that, that little leap becomes the entire accompaniment. Every measure of the accompaniment has a leap of a seventh. It almost sounds like Schoenberg if you play it by itself. I mean, this is a classical composer in the Broadway world, taking an idea, a simple opening leap, and making the whole accompaniment out of it, but it's a single line. There's no full orchestra. It starts from nothing. There's only two parts, a voice, an accompaniment of only one line. Just one line. Then, all of a sudden, you rise. Peace and quiet. And you rise to the open air, that simple scale. Suddenly, you're in the open air. You take open air. You do it higher. Anyone else would have finished. And we would have been done. But not him. They're not there yet. This is the someplace they'll never actually get to. So, you're thinking, it's open air. That's what I'm looking for. You try it higher. Wait for us. But resignedly, unfortunately, no. Somewhere. Down there. But then later, he will take that one that goes down somewhere, we're not there, and in the middle, it will go up someday with hope. What goes down becomes someday. The same melody note, change the chord underneath, becomes deeper and more emotional. Somewhere. Then, to the highest note of the piece, we'll find a way, a new way of living. Take that same melody, do it lower for forgiving, and then put in a beautiful forgiving chord. That chord is all the forgiving that we wish we could all reach to, and then back to somewhere. And then the beautiful ending of the song. So we've had someday, same note twice. Then we went in the middle to We'll Find. But this last time, we do it three times. Same notes, change the chord. Everyone expects. But instead, we do it a third time. and the two ideas of the piece meet somewhere, and there's a place for us in the accompaniment. They happen at the same time. And then we meet on the key rhythm of the whole song. They may never meet together, but the melody and the accompaniment have found their somewhere.
Never, ever thought of it like that. Never. What are you most looking forward to about this program?
Well, there's several things I'm looking forward to. One is Jessica Rivera, our soprano, is a world-famous international opera singer, and working with her is a true privilege. The other thing I'm really looking forward to, and I guess this is my connection to Bernstein, is there are all these fantastic things in this music, and I just want everyone in that audience to get it. These are pieces that almost all of us have known all our lives, but we've never really heard them. Mm-hmm. And that's really the purpose of what makes it great, to hear what we've missed.
Right. Well, thank you so much for enlightening us. It was really, really learned a lot. So
a pleasure.
Rob Capello, conductor, composer, commenter, and author. He'll be at Breaking Down the Music of Leonard Bernstein this Friday at the Sanders Theater as part of the Celebrity Series of Boston. Thanks again.
A pleasure.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.
Oh, they turn it on the heart of them.